Good morning and welcome to Current State. I'm Sue Carter in for Mark Bayshore. It's really a pleasure to be here at WKAR, on WKAR, in the Communication Arts and Sciences Building here at Michigan State, where I teach journalism one floor above. This brings me back to my radio days when I started in Lansing, and it's always a joy to sit in front of a microphone and to remember that some of those skills are still there. It gives me a little bit of street cred. A great show today has been lined up for us. So we're taking, first of all, a look at the state's personal property tax, and then we'll spend some time in our Neighbors in Action segment with people from the Resolution Center of Central Michigan. Tigers baseball, it's just around the corner. Pitchers and catchers are in. There was a game day before yesterday. We'll be talking with play-by-play man Dan Dickerson and Coast Guard Auxiliary. I know it's cold. I know it's going to get below zero. But believe me, boating season isn't that far away. So we'll be chatting with the flotilla vice commander of the Lansing Flotilla, Coast Guard Auxiliary, about getting that boat ready. First of all, though, let's talk a little bit about the property tax issue. It was 14 months ago that Governor Rick Snyder signed legislation eliminating the state personal property tax levied on business equipment. That move was heralded as welcome changes by business owners who said really the tax put them at a very competitive disadvantage and it slowed down and indeed inhibited job growth. But local governments worried, of course, how are we going to replace the revenue that kept some of those vital services running? And now a series of bills introduced at the state capitol this week in the Senate, they seek to preserve that funding. Current State's Kevin Lavery has been following the issue. He joins me now to talk about it. Good morning, Kevin.
Hi, Sue. It's nice to see you at the helm there in the host chair.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Sure. Michigan's personal property tax was a thorn in the side of businesses, particularly small companies, for decades. It'd been around for more than a century before the phase-out began in 2012. It was really viewed as an antiquated system, but more practically, it was bringing in less and less revenue in the last few years. Now, as you said in your intro there, there are 10 separate bills in the state Senate that sponsors say will completely replace the personal property tax revenue that goes to those local governments. I spoke with Rob Fowler. He's the president and CEO of the Small Business Association of Michigan, and he explained to me where this replacement funding will come from.
When the Snyder administration first came in, they changed the business tax structure, which got rid of the Michigan business tax and created the Michigan corporate income tax. When they did that, they actually stopped giving out tax credits for companies to locate in our state. A lot of people don't really understand that we really are out of the business of giving tax incentives to companies for the purpose of locating. Well, that process of giving tax credits actually has a pretty long tail on it. So tax credits given many years ago, 8 to 10, even longer years ago, are now expiring. And as they expire, it actually creates revenue to the state. That's the source of revenue that will be used. And as they continue to expire in the years to come, that revenue has really been dedicated to replacing what is lost with personal property tax.
We've heard from various communities, Dearborn, Holland, places like that, that are host communities for fairly sizable employers. The point they made is that in the past, the elimination of the personal property tax would hurt those communities, but also hurt a lot of other communities in the state. So how does the rising tide raise all boats, if that's one way of putting it?
Yeah, you know, the mayors were interesting because they have acknowledged that they know it's a problem. Tax abatements are given really at the local level. So they've been dealing with this issue of a company that won't invest in their community because of the personal property tax, and they've had to abate the tax. But their dilemma has been, and they've stated it openly, that it's a source of income that's difficult to do without. So the other thing that this legislation does today is it gives a permanent and certain replacement to the personal property tax lost. It does it through a essential services assessment that's done at the statewide level. And so some industrial equipment that's not going to have a personal property tax anymore is going to have a fee on it. It's called an essential services fee. And so while they will get some relief, they'll get a lot of relief, actually, they will continue to pay a little bit to this essential services. And so that income plus the expiring tax credits really give certainty to local governments that they will have replacement of the property tax lost.
Okay, so there is still some fee on equipment, but it is not nearly as onerous as it once was for decades.
That's correct, and it eventually falls off. I mean, part of the problem with the personal property tax is if you were a small business owner and you had a camera, a piece of equipment that you used in your business, Even when it totally depreciated, it really wasn't worth anything commercially or, you know, in the marketplace, you still paid property tax on it. Always. As long as you owned it, it had some personal property tax consequence to it, which meant, you know, things didn't depreciate, things never sort of went off the tax rolls. The essential services fee will ultimately go off the tax rolls.
What have some of your association members told you about how they have lost business to neighboring states that have never had a personal property tax?
Well, I don't know that we always pin it quite like that. That is to say, you know, doing business in Michigan, particularly if you're a border company, one of our members speaks to this often. He's got a plant in Michigan and a plant in Indiana. And he really sees the differences in the way we operate. He has investment in Indiana. He has investment in Michigan. Those are two states that actually have a personal property tax. Michigan's is about to become much less of a burden than Indiana's. What does that mean for him? So we hear that. We hear that just the cost of doing business in Michigan relative to other states generally has been a disadvantage. And I think over the last few years, we've seen some real movement in that. And it has changed pretty dramatically. I think it's an important thing to say about this proposal from a small business standpoint. What the original legislation did and what is continued in this new legislation is a total exemption for any company that has under $80,000 worth of personal property. And the reason for that is because at some level, it is actually more of a hassle to keep track of for the local governments, for them to assess it and collect it, than it's actually worth and is actually collected. We actually make we make people illegal, if you will, because they simply don't know what they're supposed to do in terms of tax payments. So the legislation will exempt anybody under $80,000 of personal property from this taxation at all. And that, to us, is that the majority of small businesses, and it just takes the hassle out of starting a company, growing a company in the early stages, and it takes the hassle out of collecting it from a local government standpoint.
If and when this package goes through and it also was approved by the voters in August, and that's a separate question, by the way, how do you quantify the type of job growth trajectory that Michigan small businesses could ultimately and hopefully head toward?
Well, this is always a difficult question to quantify with any great specificity. But I think what we know is, you know, our members have to compete with Indiana, they have to compete with India, they have to compete in a global economy, and anything the state government can do. And the state government can't do a lot as it relates to how markets play out or pricing of products or a number of things that are really outside of the purview of state government. But when they can do something, they should. And this is an example of where the state government can actually make a difference, can actually help our Michigan-based small businesses be more competitive, and we're delighted that they're taking that opportunity to do so.
This 10-bill package that is being introduced in the Michigan Senate, senators are optimistic that this could eventually come to Governor Snyder's desk by the end of March, but that's only one obstacle. It still has to be approved, first of all, in a primary in August. It's an election year, it's a tax issue, and primary turnouts historically are low anyway for any issue. So what's the campaign pitch now at this point?
Well, I agree. The challenge that we see coming really is the August primary ballot. It is a complicated issue. It's a tax issue. All of that makes it a difficult challenge to pass it. That said, I mean, I think what we saw today was enormous support from a very broad and deep set of organizations and entities. I don't know that it will have organized opposition, so I don't think anybody will be spending money to defeat it. That may still happen. I don't know that for certain, but I think most of the organized groups are in favor of this. Yet the challenge really is going to be education of the voters and the public about the beneficial impact that's going to have. Again, it's complicated, and no matter what you try to do to explain this as it must be explained on the ballot, it's going to be complicated. And so I think there's a tendency when you don't understand it to vote no. There's a tendency on complicated tax issues in particular to vote no. So we've got our work ahead of us to pass this in the August primary.
So it sounds like then there has to be a simplified yet direct message on many platforms to the voting public between right now and August.
Absolutely. And I think, we'll be looking at all avenues. Certainly the media will try to educate voters about it, and we'll speak to as clearly as we can, as often as we can. I imagine there will be a campaign, an official campaign, to try to pass it. But you're right. I think the challenge will be educating the public, the voting public, on a complicated tax matter.
Rob Fowler is the president and CEO of the Small Business Association of Michigan. Mr. Fowler, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
It's Wednesday, and that means it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment. That's where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we feature Resolution Services of Central Michigan. The Lansing-based nonprofit offers peaceful conflict resolution services for businesses, individuals, and schools, and it covers 6 mid-Michigan counties. Well, here to tell us a little bit more about it, Linda Glover, who is the Executive Director of Resolution Services of Central Michigan. Joining her is Alicia Russwinkle. She's a volunteer mediator at Resolution Services. Welcome.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you both here. Off the top, a little bit of self-disclosure, I am also an attorney, and ironically, the segment was set up before I think the people here realized that I also volunteer as a mediator at Resolution Services Center. So it gives me a little bit more knowledge and appreciation of what you all do and how important your work is. Linda, let me start with you. Can you explain exactly what Resolution Services does and
yes,
the services offered?
Definitely. We help people resolve conflict. We were established many, many years ago, in part by an action by the Supreme Court that decided we needed community organizations that helped people stay out of court, or if they're in court, to help them resolve it without prolonged litigation. So we resolve everything from cases that are in court, people suing each other, we're very active in the schools and working with students in the area of conflict resolution with our restorative justice program.
Let me pick apart that segment first, working mm-hmm. in the schools. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you're brought into, what kind of intervention, how you get involved in the schools?
Well, it's called a restorative process, and oftentimes we are called into schools when you've got a number of youth who are mad at each other. Mm-hmm. They're using Facebook to attack one another. They're bullying each other, mm-hmm. and we have a process that we go through. It starts with an intake and ends with a circle, and it's a very different process from an investigatory process. We are asking every single one of those young people, what's going on, what's been happening, ultimately, what impact is this having on you, and eventually we get to resolution. And it sounds pretty simple. The process is simple, but it's very powerful because they each get to give a narrative about what they are, what they're concerned about. Mm-hmm. So, and we're called. We are really placed in about 16 schools, mm-hmm. and then we're called into other schools on an as-needed basis.
Okay. Now, where I happen to interact as a mediator with Resolution Services is in the court. Talk to me, Linda, if you will, about how that process evolves. How do people end up going into mediation as opposed to maybe going to a trial?
Often it's the judge's decision. Mm-hmm. They are taking a look at the facts of the case, and they may decide that mediation is a more appropriate avenue for this particular dispute, and they will order it to mediation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just referred. They suggest to the parties they might try mediation. Other times it's ordered. And sometimes they're ordered to us, and other times they're just ordered to mediation, and then the attorneys who are representing the parties may say, we want to use Resolution Services, and they do that for a variety of reasons.
Okay. Now, Alicia Ruswinkle, let me bring you into this conversation. I heard that you are both a satisfied customer of this process and also someone who serves as a mediator as an attorney.
That's correct.
Yeah. What was your engagement as, let's talk about you as a client, first of all, of this. What happened there?
Well, I've actually had a number of cases where the parties either decided for cost reasons or what I would call conflict reasons that they wanted to use the resolution center. And when I say conflict reasons, what I mean is that one of the parties basically said, I don't want to use a mediator who has a strong bond or relationship with one of the attorneys because mm-hmm. they're concerned about, you know, that relationship and how that it might affect mediation. That relationship does not affect mediation, but sometimes, especially pro per parties, mm-hmm. that becomes a concern. And so with the Resolution Center, we know that they are skilled, trained mediators that can assist our clients at a reasonable cost, but also provide that anonymity that particularly when we have pro per clients who are representing themselves, they like that break from mm-hmm. what they see as kind of a relationship between many attorneys. And so one of the first cases that I became involved in, it was actually three attorneys involved, and the three of us just couldn't agree on a mediator.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the attorneys had very strong personalities, and so
that never happens, right?
Right.
Yeah, of course.
So the court basically said that they were interested in some type of alternative program, and mm-hmm. the court recommended this so that there was no relationship between any of the attorneys and the mediator. And it was a very successful mediation. It was an estate matter, mm-hmm. which has a lot of emotional components for the parties. And the outcome was very positive. We had a great resolution. And while the relationships between the parties haven't been repaired, which is unfortunate, but the result was amicable. And so that introduced me to the center. And from there, I had a few more cases. I utilized the center in a few more cases where the clients didn't have the funds or resources to pay hundreds of dollars an hour for a mediator. And I enjoyed what I was doing when I was in the center.
So you got hooked.
I did. I thought that
happens,
like a lot
it?
Of
yeah,
fun. And so
I'm not sure I'd use the word fun, but engaging.
Engaging.
Can we go with engaging?
That works. That works.
Yeah. Linda Glover, as director of the Resolution Services Center, what kind of training is required for someone who wants to be a mediator?
Good question. It's a 40-hour training that is sponsored and approved by the Michigan Supreme Court. And we offer that training. We offer it many times a year. And after someone completes that 40-hour training in the process of mediation, they then have to do an internship. Depends if they're an attorney, they have to do a shorter internship. If they're some other profession, they need to do 40 hours of observation and practice and even coaching and participating in role plays. And at the end of that time, they are then eligible to be on a court roster. They don't have to be on a court roster, and most of ours are. Most of our mediators are also listed on some court roster as a mediator, but they can just be listed with our center. And we have about 85 people who volunteer for us.
And what I pick up out of what you just said to me is that you don't have to be an attorney if you want to engage in this.
You do not have to be an attorney. There are a lot of attorneys who are mediators, but mm-hmm. we also have a lot of other professionals, including yourself, mm-hmm. You are an attorney, correct?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, you are. But there are a lot of professionals that are not attorneys, and they take our training, and then they become volunteers for the center.
Yeah, my students think it's amusing that I have a bar card. They think that it means something totally different. Yeah. We hear the phrase alternate dispute resolution a lot. Does this fit in? Or are we talking about the same thing when we're talking about the services, Linda Glover, that are provided here?
Yes, we are a form of alternative dispute resolution. There are numbers of forms of alternative dispute resolution, arbitration, something called case evaluation, where mm-hmm. your case, if it's in court, could be evaluated by a panel of three attorneys. And mediation is on that spectrum. And we are very client-focused. We don't tell clients how to resolve their case. We don't give them advice. We facilitate a process that helps them hopefully come to their own resolution. And it's amazing how often it works.
Mm-hmm. Alicia Ruswinkle, the difference between arbitration and mediation, can you talk about that?
Yes, arbitration is more akin to a trial in that generally you do submit written documentation. The rules of evidence generally aren't utilized, but you do submit evidence in different ways. And arbitrators sometimes take testimony. Often they do allow the people to speak, but the ultimate outcome is a determination made by an arbitrator. So they make the decision just mm-hmm. as a judge would, which is very different from mediation, where the parties actually come together and resolve the case on their own. And the parties have a lot more ability to formulate a conclusion to their or resolution to their problem, and they can be very creative. And arbitrators mm-hmm. are, this is what's going to happen, and this yeah. is how you're going to do it, just like a judge would do.
Right. So mediation is not binding.
Correct.
Right. Arbitration often is, can be, and really should be.
Correct.
Yeah. I know in my experience, often I will say to the parties, you know, I'm there to help them. But it's their decision. It's the conclusion that they come to or not. But if not, there's a guy in a black robe in the room next door who's going to help you, mm-hmm. help you with that. So I think sometimes that's encouraging when people realize that they have a stake. They have the opportunity then to fashion whatever the result's going to be.
That's absolutely true. There's more creativity. Now, the agreement, if they come to one, is binding. Mm-hmm. It can be considered a contract. Right. It could be enforced in court. But most of the time, there are no arguments. Once they have decided on this resolution, which is theirs, when parties make their own solutions, they don't usually come back. We track that pretty well. And mm-hmm. at least our center, we have about a 93% compliance rate that 6 months later, even a year later, people have complied with that agreement, and there was no further litigation on the case.
Well, I was going to ask you what the success rate is, but that's stunning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that keeps folks pretty balanced and pretty happy. Linda Glover, what are some of the some of the more unusual cases? You know, I mean, you always have to ask about the wild ones.
Well, I think some of the more complicated and unusual cases that we do are divorce cases. Mm-hmm. I do remember one divorce case where they had frozen embryos, and we were mediating what was going to happen with that. That's probably one of the most unusual cases that stand out in my mind. I think what's unusual about a lot of the cases, they come so angry. When they come in, they're so angry and they're so frustrated and they don't think this is going to work. And they're really kind of amazed when they're the ones that are developing the options and solutions that it does work and they can come to resolutions that are good for both of them.
Mm-hmm. So anger management, in a sense, is part of the mediation training?
Not really. How to control the process is part of the training. Mm-hmm. You really have to conduct yourself and carry yourself in a way that sets the ground rules and relates to the parties in an empathic, really a concerned and compassionate way. That when I'm mediating, and I am a mediator, I am asking them to trust me to help them through a process, but I'm not going to tell them what to do. So in terms of anger management, we have very little problem with people getting angry in mediation. They might talk loud and they get intense, but the process is one which controls that party behavior, much like a courtroom where you don't have too many outbursts. It doesn't happen very often. It has happened, but very, very seldom.
And people typically come committed. They want to win. Of course, folks want to walk away with everything, but they understand, I think, once the process engaged them, that there has to be a win on both sides.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Alicia, some interesting cases that you've had?
Well, a few of the cases that we've had actually with the center have been very interesting. One, which is a good example, we had a situation where two parties were in a domestic partnership, mm-hmm. and that can be very difficult to manage through the court system because there are not a lot of avenues and options for those clients to take. And so we had a situation where the parties owned a home and jointly. And so we had to work through not only the ownership of the home, but the ownership of the personal property. It's very much like a divorce case, mm-hmm. but there's no avenue for them to go through court to deal with this, right. with this division of assets. And so that was a very positive experience. And I think both parties were pleased with the outcome. Mm-hmm. And I think the center and the availability of the people that were there and the understanding and not passing judgment, that was really positive for these clients as well.
Excellent. Where does the funding, Linda, come from? How do you pay for this?
We sort of piecemeal a lot of different sources together to keep our doors open. Sure. And, of course, we use volunteer mediators. Even though they may be paid in their private lives, they're volunteers for us. A large portion of our funding comes from filing fees that are managed by the Supreme Court. Every time you file a case in court, you have to pay a filing fee. And a percentage of those filing fees are distributed to the 18 centers around the state. Additionally, we apply for grants. We have some steady funding coming in for some of our school programs. But on any given year, it's like all nonprofits. We have to really watch the bottom line. And the volunteers help tremendously because we don't pay our mediators.
Great. I so appreciate you taking time to come in. And what an irony to have a deeper understanding of what you do. So important. Linda Glover, the Executive Director of Resolution Services of Central Michigan, and Alicia Russwinkle, an attorney but also a volunteer with the process. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to Current State. I'm Sue Carter, filling in for Mark Bayshore. And the weather is cold outside. I looked at the temperatures for the next couple of days. We have a cold warning. What a surprise for this winter. But, you know, the boating season is not that far away. And it is important for us to realize that pretty soon we're going to be able to put the boat in the water. So with that optimistic view, joining me this morning is Jonathan Albrand. He's Vice Flotilla Commander and Public Affairs Officer for the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary. Jonathan, welcome. Good to see you again.
It's good to be here.
Oh.
Despite the cold.
Despite the cold. And really, I mean, we're coming up on March. In 2 months, people will have boats in the water. So your job then really starts to gear up as a member of the Coast Guard Auxiliary, right?
Yeah. So the role of the Coast Guard Auxiliary is basically boating safety and helping serve the Coast Guard in terms of their boating safety missions and public awareness of boating safety issues. We don't get involved at all in the enforcement side of things. But to that extent, as the season starts to kick up, the ice starts to melt, people are starting to get their boats out. Even last year when we had that really big thaw, people were out on the water, and the water was extremely cold. There was still ice chunk, but they were out there fishing and things like that. And so part of what we try to do is build awareness of things like, you know, you should wear your life jacket, especially in cold water. Mm-hmm. You should also, you know, be aware of the wind and the weather conditions and things of that sort. So we try to build some awareness. And part of that is through our public education outreach. We offer safe boating classes. And we try to do a number of those in the springtime prior to the boating season. And then we also do vessel safety checks. And we will come to your home, or we'll come to the launching ramp over at Lake Lansing, for example, and set up for a couple hours, and we'll provide free vessel safety checks to make sure the boats are compliant with state and federal regulations.
Now, how many organizations make home calls these days? That's pretty amazing.
Well, you know, we do that occasionally. And it's not uncommon for one of the auxiliarists in our flotilla to walk down the street in his neighborhood and just introduce himself to his neighbors and say, hey, I see you got a boat sitting in your front yard. Would you like a free vessel safety check?
Fantastic. You're in uniform today, and you know, people see someone in uniform, military, Coast Guard, but it's not part of the military service exactly. Can you talk about how the auxiliary fits in?
Yeah, so the Coast Guard Auxiliary actually is celebrating this year its 75th anniversary. And it was established in 1939 by Congress as basically the reserve. And then a couple of years later, they basically broke the reserve off and then made the auxiliary the volunteer civilian force. Now, What happened later on then is, as we went into World War II, there were over 50,000 auxiliary members who mm-hmm. were either serving in active duty or using their own boats and working as volunteers to provide security for the shores and the bays of the United States. So it's a very interesting relationship. There's nothing else like it out there with the other military services.
Yeah, I didn't think there was an Air Force auxiliary.
No, I mean, you know, we've heard of the, like Civil Air Patrol.
Right.
Yeah. But we work in a very unique relationship with the Coast Guard Auxiliary or the active duty Coast Guard, and there is a great amount of mutual respect and honor between the organizations. Mm-hmm. We will work with them side by side on different kinds of missions. Things like last year, for example, I had the honor of helping to escort the tall ships Bay City. And
that had to be a thrill. Those are amazing, aren't they?
That was a lot of fun. And on the water, besides us in auxiliary boats, there was the local sheriff, there was the DNR, there mm-hmm. was the active duty Coast Guard, and on their boats, of course, you know, were Homeland Security people, because this kind of an event would be a potential mm-hmm. security risk.
Right.
So we actually work just like the Coast Guard, except we're not involved in any kind of law enforcement. We're not allowed to carry weapons, and nor should we. But our mission is strictly, if any time that we can prevent an incident on the water from happening by providing education and training to someone through a safe boating class, mm-hmm. that's one less search and rescue mission that somebody will have to go out on.
So it's great preventative.
Absolutely. And we train for search and rescue. So mm-hmm. we get the same kind of training that the Coast Guard does, but they are usually the first ones that are called out.
We in Michigan love our boats. And I just looked up some statistics. Michigan has the most registered boats in the entire nation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Over 1 million is the latest figure I saw. So Michigan's number one with 1 million, followed by Florida, California, makes sense. Minnesota with its 10,000 lakes. We have more, by the way.
But we have more shoreline than any other state except Alaska.
Yeah. And Alaska doesn't even show up on the top 10, but of course the population's lower. So that's an awful lot of boats to keep a check on. Those are the registered boats, and
right.
there are, of course, some unregistered boats.
Exactly.
What does the vessel safety check entail, and what is the result of that check?
Yeah. So the vessel safety check is basically looking at a vessel and checking it for those items that are required for operation on state and federal waters.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that those things are present. And that can be many different things depending on what kind of boat you're looking at. For example, we can do a canoe and kayak safety check, and that's going to be different than a motorboat. But we look at things like life jackets, lighting, availability of the life jackets. Mm-hmm. Is there a fire extinguisher? If you have an inboard engine, do you have a spark arrest device on
right.
your engine? Do you have bilge pumps and things, are they operational? So it's really looking for the safety and operational pieces. Now, here in Michigan, that is such an important thing that mm-hmm. In the state legislature, they've actually mentioned that, when someone has completed a safety check, and this is not the rule, but this is what they have said, it is less likely that they would be pulled over if they have a safety check sticker on their boat. Now, that's not the same in every state. Other states
right.
won't do that, but that was actually mentioned last year. When you think about it, unless you're performing bad behavior on the water, you know, just the fact that you've had your boat go through that safety check, that is essentially a little micro lesson in boating safety that mm-hmm. we provide when we do the check.
And I think it really shows the respect that the legislature has for the Coast Guard Auxiliary, saying, you folks are doing a good job.
Right, right.
Yeah. You mentioned bad behavior, and I want to touch on that for just a second, because bad behavior can take in dangerous or reckless use of a watercraft.
Yeah.
If I see one more ski-doo that cuts in front of my kayak, I might be unhappy.
Yeah.
But it's also alcohol.
Oh, yeah. Alcohol is the number one contributing factor to incidents on the water. The number one overall factor for all incidents is operator inattention.
Yeah.
And that gets really interesting when you start looking at the statistics and looking at how it breaks down every year. The number one boat type is an open motor boat. And statistically, that's just because there's so many of them. In terms of death on the water, canoes and kayaks outdo, I'm not by numbers, but statistically, they're the number one. Because pretty much if you swamp a canoe or a kayak, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've done that too. It's not fun.
And of course, you know, the whole thing is wear your life jacket. Drownings, you know, that's the piece that people don't think about is when you look at the deaths on the water and the drownings, mm-hmm. most of them could be prevented. 85% of all the deaths on the drownings could have been prevented because they weren't wearing life jackets.
Mm-hmm. PFDs, personal
flotation devices.
And we think of them as life jackets. What do they look like these days? What is a PFD and what isn't? What qualifies? What doesn't?
They can be different things. Mm-hmm. And I have a couple of them. I have a nice, you know, what I call a ski vest type thing that I wear. I'm a sailor.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that because it's comfortable. It provides padding. It provides warmth in cool temperatures.
Right.
When it gets hot, you know, not as comfortable. Now, a lot of people are wearing some of these inflatable. Maybe you've seen these. These look like a pair of suspenders that go around your neck.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like the ones on the airplanes, you know, where they
do not inflate until
right.
you have left.
That's right. And some of those will auto-inflate.
Sure.
And a lot of people will get those for everyday use, and that's fine. If you fall in the water, they'll auto-inflate.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not as safe as a regular life jacket that would support your head and keep you above the water.
Right.
With those inflatables, though, they're not for kids. They're
mm-hmm.
for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key thing is you got to have the right age to be able to wear one of those. There are some things that are, and this is actually cautionary, there are some things that are popping up now called buoyancy aids that are not Coast Guard approved.
What are those?
They look like life jackets, but they have less flotation, and they're being marketed by, you know, you can get one at some place, you know, to help swim or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, right.
But that's not a Coast Guard approved life jacket. Mm-hmm. It's not going to turn your face up if you're unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to do what it's supposed to do. And unfortunately, oftentimes we'll find those on boats when we do safety inspections and say, well, you know, this is actually not Coast Guard approved. So you have to look at the label and make sure it says Coast Guard approved.
Right. And swimmies, of course, you know,
right.
for kids, I mean, they're great for starting them out to help them swim if you're with the kid in the water.
Right.
But that's about it. The Coast Guard, you know, often we think of it as, you know, the coast of the United States, the Great Lakes, but it's rivers, it's little lakes, you mentioned that, navigable places in Michigan.
Right.
Everything except your backyard pond, kind of, right?
Pretty much. I mean, the active duty Coast Guard really supports the navigable waters
mm-hmm.
of the United States. And the auxiliary, we kind of fill in the gaps in some sense because there are, I mean, you look at all the lakes that are around and, you know, we're out on patrol. I have some colleagues who are in Iowa, and that's about as landlocked as you get.
Yeah, really.
And
don't drown in corn very often.
That's right. And they still patrol rivers and streams, and they provide again some of the, you know, the vessel safety checks. They'll do the safe boating courses, and they'll go out and patrol. And they've mm-hmm. actually had rescues where they've helped people.
Certainly.
I mean, you know, people's boat will catch on fire. You know, there's a lot of incidents every year. Even here in Michigan last year, there was a tragic incident of a jet ski and a child on a tube. Year before last, there was a woman who lost her leg in Kalamazoo when mm-hmm. a boat backed over her, you know, propeller strikes. So, you know, those are inland lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the Coast Guard isn't going to come into there. But, you know, if obviously, first responders are going to be your police and fire people there, but the auxiliary can help where we can.
Right. Well, and let's touch just a second on the auxiliary. 75th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
Can anybody join?
Yeah, anybody can join. You need to be a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. You need to pass an exam and security check. So,
right.
So that is something that's a little different than a lot of other volunteer organizations, which say, hey, we're glad anybody's going to volunteer. We are glad, too. We want people to volunteer. We would like people to be actively involved. It is a little different environment because you do wear a uniform. You are representing, you know, in the eyes of the general public. When people see me, they don't see Coast Guard. They say, oh, Coast Guard. They don't understand. And candidly, it's difficult to explain to someone who mm-hmm. just says, thank you for your service, to say, well, okay, I am not active duty, but, you know, that's just... Yeah, it's just easier to make that assumption.
To just acknowledge it. And
that's
go on.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, we are serving the country.
Mm-hmm.
We are. We do carry IDs that allow us onto military bases. You know, we have to go through a background check.
Right.
But at the end, it's very satisfying. I spent 2 years in the Army when I was mm-hmm. younger, and had I known about the Coast Guard Auxiliary, I probably would have joined that after the Army. Because I really enjoy the work that I get to do here.
And maybe this broadcast will help put that word out a little bit more.
Well, we're absolutely looking for people mm-hmm. to be a part of the auxiliary. And there are many ways that you can gather skills. Even a lot of the younger people, we have a number of younger people who have come into our flotilla who are also going through things like first responder training, things of that sort. And this adds to their skill set as well. So it's a great way to add some skills, to gain some knowledge and experience that it's sort of like living an internship for a lot of young people.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking time, Jonathan, to join us today. Jonathan Albrand, Vice Flotilla Commander, Public Affairs Officer, U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary, the Lansing Flotilla. Thanks, and we'll see you out on those lakes and rivers.
Thank you.
Take care. Tiger baseball. Oh, my goodness. We were just talking about how cold it is outside, but pitchers and catchers are there down in Lakeland. We've had an early game, and Dan Dickerson, the voice of the Detroit Tigers, has just arrived in Florida. Good morning, Dan.
Hi, Sue. How are you?
I'm great. Welcome. Welcome. Just maybe a note of to share with the listeners this morning. You and I go back a long way. It's a long way. About 30 years we've worked together and known each other.
It's That's just, a long way.
It is a long way. I saw you not long ago here in this building on the Michigan State campus, and I said, Dan, you know, 10 years with the Tigers, and you reminded me it was a little different number, right?
Yeah, this is year number 15 for me.
How wonderful, how wonderful. Okay, spoil us a little bit. You've arrived just recently in Florida. What's the weather like down there?
Well, it was 84 and sunny yesterday. There's a little cloud cover at the moment, but we are in the 70s, and I'm thinking they're talking low 80s for Central Florida.
Oh, my goodness.
For this afternoon's game. It might stick in the 70s if the clouds don't move out.
Okay. You know, the Tigers had a great season overall last year, but couldn't quite get to the end where they wanted. Was that a disappointment, Dan?
Well, I think it's disappointing. I think some would say that, you know, some argue that, well, the season's a failure if you don't win the World Series. I don't think that's true for any team, even the Yankees in all their years when they had the high payrolls. And people say, well, it's a failure if you don't win the World Series. I think that's too harsh. I really do. I think if you make the postseason, you're putting yourself in the mix to win a World Championship. And think how far the Tigers have come in 12 years, and they've gone from a team that never won.
Right.
You couldn't even have a 500 season to a team that now everybody expects will be in the postseason every year. That's quite a change in really 10 years.
I think,
as a fan, I understand that everybody wants a World Championship, but you look at it critically and you say, is this a team that has a chance to win a World Championship? And almost every year the answer is yes. It may not happen, but they certainly have the pieces to do it. And I think with the changes they've made, a more versatile offense especially, Sue, this is a team that might be better suited to win and go deeper into the postseason.
And Dan, frankly, every game is an exciting game. Every game has a possibility.
Yeah, it does. And I think more interesting this year because of their ability to do more things. Mm-hmm. I think team speed is fun.
Yeah.
It's not they're going to steal a ton of bases, but they're going to steal more bases. They're going to be more active running the bases. And that makes for a more interesting game. It's fun when you challenge outfielders' arms to try to throw you out at the plate or throw you out at third.
And
they're going to do that a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Base running's felt like an Achilles heel for a good part of last year, but you're right, the changes, as we have read about them, as you're seeing them, clearly are different. What about the bullpen? That was another question mark last year.
Yeah, and it still is, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think it has a potential to be quite good, but realistically, if you're just looking at who are the guys behind Joe Nathan, who I think is a sure thing, you can legitimately say there are question marks about whatever six, and you could kind of pencil in the six right now, roughly, who are going to be leading up to Joe Nathan because of either, you know, poor performance last year like Phil Koch and Jabba Chamberlain, or young guys like Rondon who haven't pitched a full season. Ian Kroll is in that same boat, or guys who are coming off injury, like, again, Bruce Rondon. So, I mean, each one is kind of question mark. But each one, if they stay healthy and pitch a whole season, it has the potential to make this a very good bullpen. I'm really intrigued by Koch and Chamberlain are the two guys, too, that I think,
right.
I don't know if they hold the key to the bullpen, but I'm very intrigued to see what they're going to do because they both still have very good arms and are coming off poor seasons. Jeff Jones has an ability to fix things. Yeah. And I think that's why the Tigers took what probably was an eyebrow-raising move in signing Jabba Chamberlain for a lot of people, including myself. Mm-hmm. They must figure, okay, this guy's still in his mid-90s. Let's fix this guy. I see in his delivery that I can make him a better pitcher. He has the potential to be a huge part of the bullpen. Phil Koch, they have to have a solid veteran lefty. He did not have a good year last year. I think injury was a part of it. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was quite healthy. He already looks better early this spring, but he's a guy who simply has to be better because the other lefty's a rookie who's got 29 innings in the major leagues, Ian Kroll. So those are kind of two key guys.
Yeah, a brand new manager, Brad Ausmus, this year, replacing Jim Leland, who retired. Do you feel a difference in the club with the change at Skipper?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a difference in style. Mm-hmm. And I've only been down here a couple of days, but just to watch how he interacts with the team. You know, a manager, everybody hears how smart Brad Ausmus is, but there are different kinds of smarts.
Right.
I think he's book smart, but I also think he's people smart, and you have to be people smart to be a good manager. You have to know personalities and know how to handle people. But just things like turning a routine, somewhat drudgery, early drill of pitchers fielding practice, turning that into a competition. So all of a sudden, you're working a drill, getting better, but all these guys are competitive. Now you've got a competition with, quarterfinals, semis, and finals, and Jabba Chamberlain wins it, and, he's very excited to win it. I mean, to me is, that's good. That's a good way to turn something that's mundane into something interesting. Same with, catcher's drill that they had earlier. Mm-hmm. He has a 9:30 meeting with his entire team every day.
Wow.
Talk about a baseball topic, or talk about maybe here's a kid that nobody knows. Stand up, introduce yourself, tell us something about yourself. So I just think, it's a different style. Jim Leland was terrific, obviously. That was an 8-year run that was one of the most successful 8-year runs in Tigers history. So it's a little just difference in style, but I like what I'm seeing. I like what the players and how they're responding to it.
It smells like team spirit.
Yeah, and, Brad likes to downplay that. He doesn't like to talk about, but it is doing exactly that. It's building a certain amount of team camaraderie, chemistry, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. There is something to that, and he obviously believes that.
You know, I'm always impressed by the insights that Jim Price offers as a catcher. And we get some of that in, obviously a lot of that in Ausmus as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a reason that, by far the position most represented among major league managers is catcher. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost half now.
Yeah.
The major league managers were catchers. So there's a reason for that. There's a certain analytical ability that they have that goes along with that position. And, in the case of my partner, Jim, he can see that batter pitcher matchup and he understands that batter pitcher matchup, what each one is trying to do at the plate, what each one has that day, extremely well. He just has that ability to see that, other people don't have. And I think that's one of the things that the Tigers liked about Brad Ausmus, among the many things. But there's a reason catchers are well represented in the managerial fraternity.
Looking at the league for the coming season with the changes that were made, any thoughts about how the American League might shake out this year?
Well, it's pretty interesting. I tell you one thing, it's hard to predict. Every year, the very best minds in this business try to predict.
Yeah.
And every year, they usually have a very tough time picking more than 3 division winners. I think the Tigers are one of the more sure things. I always look at teams that jumped up a lot. Will they fall back? Boston and Cleveland fit in that category. I happen to think both are going to actually hold most of their gains from last year. Boston looks strong again, even though they lost some key players. And I think Cleveland's probably the biggest threat. I'm intrigued by the Angels. I don't think they have, they've got a big payroll and obviously were a disappointment last year, but I'm not sensing that they're going to jump up because I think their starting pitching is weak. I think for fans, I always start with starting rotations. Look at the best starting rotations. Do they have enough hitting to go along with that? And then you kind of gauge who has maybe the best chance to win a given division. But to me, it's Tampa Bay, Boston in the East, with the Yankees certainly a threat. Tigers and probably Cleveland in the Central. I'm not sold on Kansas City's improvement because I don't think they have enough offense. And in the West, I think Texas is a real force, but they've got some pitching problems. So, you got to look at the Oakland A's again. They won that division 2 years in a row, and they certainly have the pieces to do it again.
The amazing A's. Dan, finally, just a couple of seconds left. What time is the game today?
1:00 game today. And we'll broadcast today's game and then skip tomorrow, and then we'll do the next four after that. 22 in all.
Oh, how wonderful.
Spring.
Oh, yeah. It lightens our spirit to know that there
is hope. It does, and I know,
there is hope.
Believe me, I was there all winter long.
I've
never seen a winter like it. Everybody's ready for a little bit of Florida sunshine, even if it's just coming over the radio.
Well, enjoy Joker Marken Stadium. It's a wonderful place to be a fan there, and just fantastic. We'll be with you in spirit, if not there physically.
All right. Great talking with you, too.
Good to talk to you, too. Dan Dickerson, play-by-play, the voice of the Detroit Tigers, and time to play ball. Thanks, Dan.
You bet.
Lansing area residents, by the way, can get their first look tonight at a draft plan to revitalize a major community asset. Over the past year, hundreds of people have expressed their thoughts on improving the Michigan Avenue and the Grand River Avenue corridor, the so-called Capitol Corridor Vision. It focuses on a 19-mile stretch from the Capitol Building downtown Lansing east all the way to Weberville. Regional planners have compiled public input on retail development, urban design, bus rapid transit, and some other quality of life issues. So they're going to present their summary report to the public tonight. It's at the Hanna Community Center on Abbott in East Lansing. Doors open at 5:30. The event starts at 5:45. Now, remember, this is only a draft report. Implementation is not expected for 2 or 3 years. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Off the Record's Tim Skubick. He'll be the host. He'll analyze February's top Michigan news stories for our month in a review segment. Also, we'll have a look at a book review from a Current State contributor, Scott Southard. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Linstroth is a producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also, Aaron Young, great engineer, and Hannah McNeil John and Kelsey Block for production assistance. I'm Sue Carter. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.